Yeah. In the clear sky, Mei Lin can see a dark V, like birds in strict formation. Dismay spreads through her body. The Japanese have reached Chongqing. On the street, the crowds are dispersing. An air raid siren begins its wail, low and slow at first, then building in pitch and volume until it reaches an ear-splitting shriek. It stops to reset and starts again, insistent. It's too loud. The helplessness and fear she'd felt during the strafing attack outside Yichang, absent for months, now return and overwhelm her. She can't think. She can't move. People are running past. Hurry! Hurry! Take cover! Now, the planes are so near, she can see the brilliant red circles on their wings. Shop doors are closing. Shutters rattle down. Renshu begins to whimper. A man carrying a toddler shakes Mei Lin's shoulder, breaking her paralysis. He gestures down the street. Go to the great tunnel. The Shibati gate is over there. With her basket in one hand and Renshu's fingers clasped in the other, she follows. They descend a staircase that disappears into the ground just as the gates clang shut behind them. A whistling shears the air, wind gusting at their backs. Then a deafening explosion. Renshu screams and Mei Lin pulls him closer. The ground trembles. Inside the tunnel, bare light bulbs flicker and sway. Frightened eyes gleam in the light. More whistling and echoing explosions, again and again. The lights blink once more, then go out. All around, people are crying and shouting. Renshu begins to sob. Mei Lin wraps her arms around him. Skin to skin, she tries to soothe him, soothe herself. She tries to rub away the sickening sense of defeat. This mountain city was supposed to protect them. They had been so safe. In the dark, tears slip down Mei Lin's face. They wait. She loses all sense of time. The walls of the tunnel weep too, releasing moisture. Has it been minutes? Hours? Occasionally, a torch or candle flashes in the darkness. The tunnel is dotted with the red glow of cigarettes producing too much smoke. The air is sour with the reek of garlic and tobacco. People push and jostle, trying to make more room. Renshu coughs, and Mei Lin tries to breathe through her mouth. The thunderous explosions don't relent. All around Renshu, fingers poke, hands grope, knees knock into his legs. Other people's hips and bellies bump too close to his neck, his ears. He can't breathe. His head hurts and he feels dizzy. He wants to get out of this tunnel. Someone shouts that the doors are open and people scramble to get outside. Someone shoves him from behind and Renshu loses his ma's hand. A wave of people carries him away from her. Ma! Ma! His shouts are lost in the crush of shoulders and elbows. The instant Mei Lin feels Renshu's hand drop away, she starts shaking. Panic shoots down her arms. If she can't get to him, he will be trampled. She pushes back against the surge. People curse and push and move around her. She doesn't hear them. She must find Renshu. Nothing matters more. There! He has fallen. She kneels to get him. He has fainted. She lifts him and carries him, stumbling forward, now moving with the motion of the crowd until they are finally, finally outside. Clutching Renshu, she crumples against a wall, gulping in big lungfuls of air. Dusk has dulled the sky, but flames burn brightly in every direction. Sulphur curls around piles of rubble. Cinders float by. People emerge from shelters in stunned silence, walking slowly. Cries begin to rise from every direction as loss after loss is discovered. Some hurry towards the sounds of distress to help dig out those buried in debris. Others wander in disbelief, choking and coughing. Although the sirens are silent and bombs no longer whistle down, there's a constant crackle of flames, punctuated by the splintering creak and crash of collapsing buildings. Entire blocks have been demolished. Craters as wide as houses mark where the bombs exploded. Among the wreckage are fragments of snap furniture, overturned tables, flattened bookshelves. Shop fronts wobble, their facades cheerfully advertising cigarettes or tailoring. Behind lie only piles of broken masonry and shattered glass. A few blocks away, in the middle of the street, they see the fancy rickshaw again, overturned. One of the wheels is still spinning, squeaking. The black lacquer and gold trim is spattered with blood, dust, and bits of white and pink. Malin nearly retches. She swallows back her nausea and drags Renshu away before he can see what she has. A hand attached to an arm attached to no body. In the park, the cigarette seller stand is an ash heap. When Renshu sees the scattered peacock plumes but no sign of Manzi, he again bursts into tears. Back in their rooms, Meilin has never been so relieved to see Longwei, Wenling, and the girls. Somehow, they too have survived. Longwei says they sheltered in another public tunnel, closer to home. While Wenling complains about how uncomfortable, dark, and dirty it was, Meilin despairs. How could the Japanese have made it all this way? Through the winter and early spring, the fogs and mists were so thick they'd kept the skies quiet. She had begun to believe they might have escaped it all. She'd trusted they'd be safe in the interior. Now, where is there left to run? Through the night, the city blazes and no one sleeps. The next morning dawns clear and bright. It is the anniversary of the May 4th Revolution. Of all days, today is one to celebrate the Republic, the spirit of the Chinese people. Meilin rallies. Determined to find something to brighten the family's day, she and Renshu head back to the market. Meilin is heartened to see that the shops which are still standing raise their shutters and open their doors. In the streets, people are clearing the rubble, speaking of resilience. At 5 o'clock, the air raid sirens start up once more. Again? Meilin despairs. In the sky, a swarm of flies approaches. The optimism of moments before is crushed. Meilin and Renshu shelter with the family in the public tunnel closest to the flat. They endure the raid by repeating verses of the San Zi Jing over and over. Even Wenling joins in. Finally, the weather turns cloudy. A respite from the bombings follows. The days are spent looking for survivors, helping the wounded, pumping water to put out fires. Monks from Arhat Temple circulate among the debris, chanting, conducting rituals for the dead. Carts and baskets fill with limbs. Bodies are laid out in neat rows so that people can recognize loved ones. Only a few are claimed and taken away for proper burial. More are left, and soon maggots nest and feast on the rotting flesh. In the depths of night, when the streets are empty, rats and vermin scurry. The clear skies of summer become an invitation for more Japanese planes, and Meilin loses track of the days they spend crouched underground. When autumn comes, while it's clear the war is far from over, Chongqing has become a city of resistance, and somehow life continues. Wenling and Longwei enroll the girls in boarding school in Xiaopingba, a neighbourhood about 15 miles away. Wenling pleads to move to Xiaopingba too, but Longwei refuses. They are lucky to have the rooms they do, he says. She always expects too much. She's never satisfied, he grumbles. When Longwei suggests that Renshu go to school too, Meilin protests that he's only 5. She'll teach him herself. What she doesn't say is that she hates becoming even more beholden to Longwei. She's never sure when his goodwill might run out, or if he's expecting something in exchange for all his munificence. Is his charity still an act of filial piety, honouring his lost father and brother? Family stays together, he says. But she doesn't trust him. She knows too little about where he spends his days. Soon, Wenling befriends some of the mothers at the girls' school. They are wives of bankers, businessmen and high-ranking officials. Wenling begins taking a sedan chair to their houses and shopping bar a few times a week to gossip or play mahjong. claiming she needs to be near the girls and frequently stays the night. Meilin, too, has made new friends among her favourite vendors in the Shiba Tea Market. There's Auntie Deng and Uncle Liang, who bring in beautiful produce from Chengdu. Uncle Liang has a soft spot for Renshu, and always slips him extra fruit. They both poke fun at Meilin's smattering of Sichuanese mixed with Mandarin, but they also encourage her. Since their arrival last February, Meilin's fluency has improved greatly. Meilin grows to know other familiar faces too. Mr. Huang, who runs a restaurant, also likes Auntie Deng's produce. Grandma Si, who sells cloth, admires Meilin's handiwork with her needle. More than once, they have all had to flee to the Great Tunnel together during an air raid. With the girls at school and Wenling frequently away, Meilin and Renshu are often on their own. During the quieter days, they unroll the scroll and linger over scenes, telling each other the old stories and making up new ones. Each time Meilin unfastens the tassel, the scent of the sandalwood rollers rises like a ghost and she inhales deeply. It is as if, with just that single breath, Xiaowen has returned. The gold threads along the edges glint a greeting. Without fail, Meilin always finds something new to admire in the detail she has treasured for so long. The scroll, its miraculous existence, its never-ending beauty, is a well of hope. Renshu's favourite scene is the marketplace. They like to see how many cheats and rascals they can spot. Look, a boy steals fish from a bucket while the seller haggles with an old woman in a shawl. Over there, behind the chickens in wicker cages, a tall man slips eggs into his deep pockets. The sorghum seller's scales tilt at a dishonest angle. See, below the table, his son, already an expert swindler, pulls a string to indicate an apparent balance well before the sides hold equal weights. And everywhere, pickpockets help themselves to the baskets of the naive country folk who, having travelled far to sell their harvests, celebrate their earnings with too much plum wine. Even the dogs are thieves in this market, snuffling their noses along the tables to snatch a bun or a pork roll before someone chases them away. In the corner is a fortune teller. Meilin and Renshu are unsure whether she is a fraud. Some days, they decide she is the only true and kind person in the market. Her tea leaf divinations and I Ching readings are known for miles. People trust her to utter chants that cure illnesses, to tell them what sacrifices will honour the ancestors, and to read their children's stars in hopes of auspicious beginnings. But on bad days, they say she is the worst crook of them all. She sells shoddy promises, which is far worse than peddling cheap cloth or using faulty scales. The damage she does is unforgivable because it hurts their hearts. Sometimes Meilin wonders what comes next in their story. How long will they be in Chongqing? Everyone is waiting to go home, but Meilin is no longer sure where home is. No replies come from her letters to her family. In the spring, she decides she'll enroll Renshu in the local school. Without the company of his cousins, she worries he'll be lonely. And while he's at lessons, maybe she can find some paid work nearby. She doesn't want to stay in the shadow of Longwei and Wenling forever. Chapter 6. Chongqing, Sichuan Province, China, June 1941. In early June, the girls return to Chongqing for a short stay. With them back around, Wenling is happier to be home, and she is civil, even conversational, with Meilin. Li Fen, now 11, is helping Wenling make tea for the family. The steam rises from the pot as she pours hot water over the leaves. Wenling arranges 5 teacups and some plates of peanuts and melon seeds on an enamel tray. When the tea and snacks have been distributed, Wenling nods to Li Fen, who returns to her book. Wenling picks up the newspaper with great interest. Meilin watches Li Ling and Renshu chattering away in the corner. They sit together on a quilt. They have put their cups and snack plates on a stool as if it is a small table and sit cross-legged on either side. Meilin notices Li Fen eyeing them over the top of her book.
Li Fen,
says Meilin. Tell me about your school in Xiaopingba. The girl, grateful to be included, joins Meilin at the table. They chat about teachers, friends, favourite subjects. Eventually, the talk turns to air raids. Auntie, Lifan addresses Meilin, in my school, even when we run to the shelters, we still do our lessons. That's good. Learning is important, Meilin says, wanting to praise her niece, who has always seemed caught between childhood and maturity. Yes, it's very good, the school, Wenling remarks, looking up from the paper. Their bomb shelters are equipped with seats and lights for studying. When the sirens sound, the students take their books and run to the caves. Here in the city, Meilin gripes, the tunnels are cramped and stuffy and hot. And now that even more refugees have arrived, they are so crowded. Everyone has assigned shelters, but when the air raid sirens go, there's not all this time to reach them. People just squeeze into whichever one is closest. I've heard that there are special shelters for bureaucrats and officials, Wenling comments, with bars and provisions. These guys spend the air raids enjoying cards, dancing girls and drinks. Dancing? Meilin exclaims in disbelief. It's true, Wenling insists. One of the school mothers told me. She sighs and looks around the room. I wish my husband would get us transferred to Xiaopingba. There are fewer bombings and the shelters are better. My friends hide in caves dug into the sides of the hills. They store mats there so they don't have to sit on the cold ground. Wenling lifts her teacup to take a sip and grimaces. She spits it back into the cup. Too cold! She rises. Lifan, Liling, come along. We need to go to the tailor's to choose fabrics for your summer dresses. Lifan, happy for the attention, starts to get ready. But Liling ignores her mother and continues playing with Renshu. Liling! Wenling repeats, clapping her hands. I don't want to go, Liling mutters. What? Wenling says, her voice dangerously quiet. Liling turns her face up towards her ma. I want to stay here with Renshu and Auntie. I don't care what my dresses look like, she declares. Liling! Wenling steps forward, hand raised to strike. Wait! Meilin cries out instinctively. Wenling turns on Meilin. Don't interfere! This is none of your business! No, of course not, big sister, Meilin retreats. But I'm happy to look after her if you want to take Lifan. It's so hot out, and with her short legs and sour mood, she'll only slow you down. Why don't you two go ahead? Wenling fumes briefly. Fine, she finally says. It's easier without you, Liling. Just don't you dare complain if you don't like your dresses. Liling has been shifting her gaze between Meilin and her ma. When Wenling relents, Liling smiles at her, a little too sweetly, and goes back to playing with Renshu. Once Wenling and Lifan have gone, Meilin puts away the tea things, then gets her sewing basket to do some mending. Renshu and Liling are talking about their schools. Liling likes hers, but Renshu's not so sure about his. It's hard to sit still, and repeating his brushstrokes hundreds of times to practice characters is dull. Renshu, Meilin interrupts, hating to hear him complain. I cannot change your teachers or their methods, but I can tell you a story.
A scroll story?
Yes, a scroll story. Renshu's face lights up and he goes over to her basket to take out their treasure. Meilin puts away her mending and Liling and Renshu sit by her side. Can you find a hermit in a thatched mountain hut? A busy city down in the valley and a palace with horses and soldiers and banners flying in the wind. They pore over the scroll, unrolling and re-rolling it, section by section, searching for the scene she has described. When they find it, Meilin begins. There was once an emperor who loved roosters. One day, he asked his advisers, who is the finest artist in the land? Your Excellency, they said. By far the most talented artist of all is Master Wen, who lives high in the hills of Dabashan. Bring him here, boomed the emperor. So the emperor's men went into the mountains, searching along old trails almost lost to time, until, at last, they found Master Wen. They explained that he must come see the Emperor at once. Master Wen lay down his brushes and put on his shoes. He wrapped his robes around himself and, without a word, followed the Empress men down the mountain and into the palace. Such riches! Such gold! They led him along a corridor lined with 100 soldiers and 100 glittering dragon lamps. At the end, Master Wen bowed to the Emperor, who sat on a sumptuous golden throne.
"They tell me you are the finest artist in the land."
Master Wen stood up straight and nodded.
"I want the best painting of a rooster the world has ever seen. Just for me. I commission you."
"Of course, Your Excellency. But I need 2 years.
2 years?
Sputtered the Emperor, turning a bright red. The Emperor was not accustomed to waiting 2 minutes for anything, let alone 2 years. The 100 soldiers stared straight ahead. No one blinked or uttered a word. But Master Wen simply held up 2 fingers.
"Very well. Take 2 years, then return with my painting. If it is as marvellous as I expect, then you shall have all the tea and ink and scrolls you desire. You may spend the rest of your years writing poetry, practicing calligraphy and painting landscapes."
There were quiet murmurs throughout the hall.
"But," thundered the Emperor, holding up a hand to make his conditions clear, "should you fail to produce a painting that pleases me, then the painting will be burned, and you along with it."
Master Wen nodded and returned to his hut. 2 years passed, and the Empress men came again to the mountains. Master Wen's moustache and beard had grown longer and greyer, but his eyes were as sharp as ever. He greeted them at his hut, then picked up a scroll, his favourite brush, his inkstone, and an ink cake.
"I am ready."
Back down the mountain, back into the city, to the palace, and down the same long corridor with 100 soldiers and 100 glittering lamps. This time, the Emperor, who had grown even fatter, sat on silk cushions in robes of red and gold. Master Wen bowed.
"Where is my painting?" boomed the Emperor.
Master Wen unrolled the scroll, and to everyone's shock, the silk was blank.
"May I have some water, Your Excellency?"
A servant hurried forward with a flask. Master Wen took the water, poured it in the well at the bottom of his inkstone, unwrapped his ink cake, and began to scrape the cake against the well, mixing ink. A wonderful scent of camphor, pine, and fresh flowers filled the air. When he was satisfied with the ink's consistency, he dipped his brush into the dark pool and lifted it out, careful not to spill a single drop. He touched the brush to the scroll, and the ink began to bleed onto the silk. His hand moved deftly, pausing here, accelerating there, sometimes making the stroke thick, sometimes thin. The brush danced with agility and grace, and before everyone's eyes, a rooster appeared. With the last bit of ink in his dish, Master Wen added a final flourish on the coxcomb. For some time, the hall was silent. Finally, the Emperor spoke.
"Master Wen, that is indeed the most astonishing rooster painting I have ever seen. You shall have your tea and ink. But first, I must know. That took you no more than 3 minutes. Why did you need 2 years?"
The artist dried his inkstone with the hem of his robe and wrapped his ink cake in silk, tenderly wiping his brush clean. When he had finished, he beckoned from the Emperor to come close.
"Come visit my workshop," he whispered in the Emperor's ear.
When the Emperor and his men arrived at Master Wen's home in the mountains, they found stacks and stacks of paper, covered with sketches and studies and partially finished paintings of roosters. Roosters and roosters reaching all the way to the ceiling.
Ren Xu and Li Ling laugh. "That is what Mei Lin hoped for,
what she always hopes for when she tells them a story. If they laugh, they'll remember it. And if they remember it, they'll always have this piece of home, of her. A few days later, Meilin, Renshu and Liling are in the market, visiting Meilin's friends. Renshu and Liling sit on an upturned crate, each eating a stem of longans from Uncle Liang. Auntie Deng is making a fuss over Liling, saying how pretty she is. What a doll! Liling smirks. She's more of a tomboy than a doll, Meilin thinks. But over the past 2 years, the girl has grown into a real beauty, with a striking resemblance to Wenling. Meilin wonders if this is behind their increased battles. Liling, increasingly rebellious, has been arguing with Wenling throughout their summer visit, wanting to spend more and more time with Renshu and Meilin. Today's outing, of course, provoked another confrontation. Finally, Wenling had thrown her hands up, saying, "Go! Go run around in the dirty market with your cousin. I'd rather have the peace and quiet anyway." Liling had screamed back, "And I'd rather be with Auntie and Renshu. I wish you weren't my mother. I wish Auntie was my ma." At this, Wenling slapped the girl hard and left the room. It took most of the morning for Liling to calm down. Determined to keep Wenling and Liling away from each other for as long as she could, Meilin has stayed in the market far longer than necessary. But the sun is setting. They should go. As much as Meilin dreads facing Wenling, she needs to start preparing the evening meal. Longwei is expected back from meetings in Guilin, and the whole family is meant to be together before the girls return to school. Meilin glances up at the sky. Perhaps they can linger for just a little longer. It's been days since the last airstrike. At the onset of the war, the Japanese army had boasted that it would take over China in a handful of months. It has now been nearly 4 years, and China still holds the aggressors at bay. But this is cold comfort. By now, Meilin and Renshu have survived hundreds of bombings. Still, Meilin's uneasy. Clear skies are always the worst, the most dangerous. They shouldn't stay out in the open. Auntie Deng is telling a story when the moan of the air raid sirens begins. She stops mid-sentence. Renshu scans the sky for the incoming formation. Liling looks at Meilin, eyes wide. "Auntie, I'm scared," she whispers. "It will be okay, Liling," Meilin reassures her, trying to sound calm. "We'll go into the Great Tunnel. It's nearby. Stay close with us." "I want my ma," the girl wails, bursting into tears. "Here, hold my hand, little one," Uncle Liang says to Liling. "I'll keep you safe." He takes her small hand and they start running towards the Great Tunnel. Meilin hurries Renshu along, but he tugs back. "Hurry," she says. "It will fill and we won't get in. We need to go now." But Renshu is obstinate. No, he won't budge. Families rush by. The sirens roar. Meilin shouts, "Renshu, there's no time to argue." The fleet swarms closer. Meilin catches glints of sunlight reflecting off their wings. Doors are shutting. Merchants are abandoning newly repaired stalls. Finally, Meilin tries to scoop her son up. At 6 years old, he is too big to carry. He kicks at the air and flounders out of her arms. "I hate the tunnel. The air is bad. I won't go." Meilin sees a new stubbornness and deep fear in his eyes. She stumbles. Renshu wrenches free and starts to run in the opposite direction. "No, come back," she shrieks, but he is too quick. 3 blocks later, Meilin catches him, but they have lost sight of Auntie Deng, Uncle Liang and Liling. Scolding Renshu, she struggles to drag him back. Halfway down the steps to the entrance, she sees the gates have closed. The officials refuse to let them in. "Too crowded, already full," they say, implacable. Meilin looks past their shoulders. The tunnel is heaving with people, more crowded than she's ever seen it. They crouch outside the gate, under the partial shelter, hoping it will be enough. For hours, the planes circle overhead. Without thick walls to muffle the explosions, each window shattered or wall crumbled, vibrates straight into Mei Lin. Her ears ring and her body shudders with the aftershocks. Expecting each moment to be their last, she hovers over Renshu, who cries and cries. With the fall of darkness, fewer bombs land, but the fearsome drone of the planes continues. Hours after dusk, Mei Lin finally raises her head. It finally sounds like the planes are growing more distant. Maybe soon the all-clear signal will sound and the gates will open. She helps Renshu to his feet and they venture up the stairs. Then, shouts from the tunnel behind them, "The lamps are going out!" There's not enough oxygen for the flames, which means there's not enough oxygen for the people. Turning back to look down at the entrance, Mei Lin feels a new kind of terror. Despite the increasing calls for help, the guards still refuse to open the gates. They insist they must wait for official instructions. Pandemonium erupts in the tunnel. People are screaming, pushing, moaning, trying to get out. They are clawing, tearing at their clothes. "Open the gates! Open the gates!" Was it a blessing to be denied entrance after all? Mei Lin wonders, then is shocked by her own thoughts. Auntie Deng, Uncle Liang, and Li Ling are trapped inside. One wooden gate opens partially, and the crowd begins to pour out like a torrent, a stampede. Mei Lin clings to the side of the steps, shielding Renshu as people surge by, tripping, stumbling, trampling over those who have fallen. Auntie Deng staggers out, gasping, her clothes torn. Mei Lin feels the fists around her heart begin to loosen. Mei Lin helps Auntie Deng over to them. Her ankle is sprained. The three make their way up the stairs to wait for Uncle Yang and Li Ling.
"Where's Li Ling?"
Renshu asks.
"They were right behind me," Auntie Deng pants. They'll come out soon."
But after that first wave, although the blood-curdling shrieks continue, people stop emerging. Some of the young men who have escaped the tunnel try to re-enter to aid those still inside. Their efforts are futile. When they climb back out, they say that the tunnel has been blocked by the bodies of those who have fainted, or worse, suffocated. Mei Lin keeps her eyes locked on the tunnel's opening, her guilt and dread growing as the hours pass. Renshu, frightened into silence, clings to her. Though exhausted, wariness keeps him alert.
"Liang! Liang!"
Auntie Deng paces back and forth, her own injuries forgotten as she calls. Through the night, the other gates to the tunnel stay stubbornly closed. The officials haven't sounded the all-clear. Without instruction from higher-ups, the wardens refuse to budge. No rescue teams arrive. Thousands remain stuck in the unbearable heat and toxic air. It is only after daybreak that officers come, not to rescue, but to clear the corpses. Among the bodies are those of Uncle Liang and Li Ling. In the weeks following Li Ling's death, everyone reels with grief. Long Wei funnels his anguish into his work. Through official channels, he tries to find out what went wrong in the chain of command. He reports back that the Generalissimo was distressed by the disaster, and the Air Defense Commander and Deputy Air Defense Commander will be relieved of their duties. He testifies before a committee that the higher-ranking officials failed to protect the public. In contrast, Wen Ling retires to her bed, hardly eating or speaking, her eyes swollen and face bare, uninterested in visits from her shopping bar friends. She barely protests when Li Fan refuses to return to school. Renshu too stays home, not wanting to go into the city. He tries to play with Li Fan, and though she is sometimes kind, it's not the same. No one else is like Li Ling. Desperate to keep the household running, Mei Lin tries to maintain her usual routines, but inside she feels wretched. The tragedy is her fault. It's the Japanese army's fault. It's the officials' fault. The wardens who were blindly obedient. The engineers who designed the tunnels. It's no one's fault. It's everyone's fault. Attempting to escape this vortex of helpless regret, Maylin tries to comfort Wenling. There are no words that can soothe this loss, so Maylin prepares Wenling's favourite dishes. Today, she has brought back fresh greens and a small amount of pork. She has spent hours cooking. When Maylin serves the food, Wenling pushes away her bowl in distaste. Stop trying to make things better. Everything you do just makes things worse.
We're all grieving, Maylin murmurs, exhausted, then immediately regrets it.
Wenling lifts her head, her eyes glittering with hostility. You were supposed to look after her, she says.
Maylin wants to sob. She can't deny it.
Why did I trust you? You have been poisoning her against me ever since leaving Changsha. If you weren't here, none of this would have happened.
I'm so sorry, Wenling. I'd do anything to change that day.
Wenling cuts her off. For years, my friends have asked me why I let my family be dragged down by my dead brother-in-law's widow and son. Why I didn't stand up for myself and demand you leave. Find a life of your own. But I always said, no, my youngest loves them so much. And now, this softness of mine has resulted in her death. I should have insisted you go your own way ages ago. I should have been stronger. You have brought nothing but misfortune to us. Because of you and your son, my child is dead. It was an accident.
Maylin's temper flares, then fizzles when she sees the sharp pain on Wenling's face.
Wenling has lost a child. There is nothing Maylin can do to change that.
I don't want to fight, Wenling, Maylin says. I too feel as if I have lost a daughter.
At this, Wenling shrieks, no, 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 she was not your daughter. How dare you? You who have taken her life, now you also try to claim her in death?
What can I do?
Maylin asks, exhausted.
Wenling stares past Maylin, looking at the wall.
I want you and your son to get out. I want...
She looks up at the ceiling and her voice is unsteady.
I want to never have to see you again.
Maylin has known derision, scorn and contempt from Wenling. She has been the recipient of her mockery and impatience. But underneath it all, Maylin has always believed there was some kind of bond, some sense of family, however minute. But this is different. In Wenling's voice, there is no trace of warmth or grudging kinship, only a cold and certain hate. Renshu and Lifen have stopped eating, watching their mothers in a frigid silence. Come, Maylin says to Renshu, putting down her chopsticks and bowl. She gets up from the table and goes into their room. Though it is Chongqing's steamy summer, Renshu doesn't protest when Maylin tells him to put on all his clothes, as many layers as possible. He doesn't say a word when Maylin packs their most precious belongings into her sewing basket. Despite its age, it is still strong and holds all that they need. Solemn and silent, he understands that, once again, it's time to go. When they leave, Wenling doesn't even look up.
Part 2, 1941 to 1948. Chapter 7, Chongqing, Sichuan Province, China, August 1941.
Their loss should bring your family together, not tear it apart, Auntie Deng mourns.
Maylin wipes away the tears rolling down her cheeks. Not knowing where else to go, she'd come to the market.
So, you need a place to stay? Auntie Deng asks.
Maylin nods.
Stay with me for a little while. Without Liang, I could use some help here in the market. Let's see what happens. Maybe we all need some time to heal.
Auntie Deng squeezes Maylin's hand and gives Renshu a hug.
I don't want to go back,
Maylin whispers, surprising herself. It only takes a few days before Long Wei comes to the market looking for Maylin. Renshu sees him first and runs to his uncle, giving him a great embrace and chattering excitedly about how they've been staying with Auntie Deng.
When Maylin comes out from behind the stall, where she's been helping to unload a fresh shipment of greens, Longwei sets Renshu down. Longwei's cheeks look hollow and he is unshaven. His grief is still raw.
"What happened?"
he asks Maylin, holding Renshu close to his side.
"Wenling wouldn't tell me. She just said that you left."
Maylin looks away, refusing to make eye contact.
"Maylin, listen. After Liling..."
He trails off and tries again.
"Maylin, my request to transfer to Xiaping Ba has been granted. We're moving to where we'll be safer. Will you come with us?"
"Elder brother," Maylin says, "Wenling doesn't want us there. And she's right. We have relied on your kindness for too long. We need to make our own way."
"And how will you do that?"
he asks, his voice tinged with disbelief. Maylin bristles at his tone. True, she has relied on him until now, but she can take care of herself and Renshu. After all, that was her promise to Xiaowen. Longwei picks up an orange, passing it from hand to hand. Maylin turns away to help another customer at the stall.
"You want more oranges?"
Auntie Deng limps over to him, collecting more and putting them into his hands.
"Very juicy, very tasty."
When the customer is gone, and Auntie Deng has sold Longwei many oranges and a half dozen persimmons, he says to Maylin,
"We are leaving the apartment at the end of the month. At the very least, you and Renshu can stay there once we're gone."
Maylin doesn't say anything. He sighs, says goodbye to Auntie Deng and Renshu, and tells Maylin to think about it. Then he leaves.
"Maylin,"
Auntie Deng says, as soon as he is out of earshot,
"you can go back now. See? It's going to work out."
"But I don't want to. Don't you still need our help here, Auntie?"
"Maylin," Auntie Deng tuts, "don't be foolish. They are your family."
"No, not anymore. Look, you've got a customer." Maylin nods towards a woman browsing the sweet potatoes. But later that week, Auntie Deng tells Maylin,
"When the summer ends, I'm returning to Chengdu. You and Renshu have been a great help, but it's too hard to be here without Liang. It doesn't feel right."
Although Auntie Deng rarely shows her grief, Maylin has heard her weeping at night.
"Besides," Auntie Deng continues, "my daughter has a new baby. She needs help with the other children."
She holds up her hand before Maylin can protest.
"At the end of the month, when I leave, if you still won't join your brother-in-law, then go back to that apartment. If it stands empty, someone else will move in and you'll lose this chance. Put away your pride and anger, Maylin. Things are hard enough already."
In September, as the heat subsides, Maylin and Renshu return to the vacated rooms. During the day, they stay at the apartment so that when the air raid sirens start, they can rush to the smaller shelter nearby. Of course, Renshu is terrified of this tunnel too. Every time, Maylin must convince him it is the only safe choice. They avoid Shibati altogether. Without Auntie Deng, the market becomes only a reminder of that terrible day in June. Renshu's playfulness has dimmed. In its place is a protectiveness of Maylin and a new wariness. Although he misses his uncle, auntie, and Li Fen, he seems to have sensed the rift and doesn't ask about them. Most of all, though, Renshu misses Li Ling. Every night he cries and cries until he falls asleep. His fears flare up in nightmares, and Maylin's nights are broken too as she tries to coax him back to sleep. He says he wishes he would wake up to find Li Ling there, laughing, asking him to play, telling him a funny story, or sharing her sweets with him. But no matter how hard he cries or how much he wishes, nothing brings her back. With October, the fog returns and the bombings finally lessen. Maylin gets Renshu back to school. Routine helps them both. Yet, in this quieter season, Maylin's unhappiness and loneliness cut deeper. When Renshu is at school, she finds she cannot stop weeping. a dam has burst, and years of grief flood through her. For so long, Maylin has held her sorrow at bay. There was always something more pressing than grief, a need to find food and shelter, to attend to the family's feelings, to simply survive the day. But now, without the pressure of immediate crisis, without the constant daily tension of navigating between Longwei and Wenling, her vigilance shifts to melancholy. In the wake of so much loss, she mourns not only the life she'd intended for Renshu, stability and safety, an untroubled childhood watched over by Xiaowen, but also all that he has experienced that she cannot undo. Even if the war were to end tomorrow, he'll inherit a country of burned cities, displaced people, broken families. In her despair, Maylin discovers something else too. Anger. Anger at the damage that has been done. Anger that so many possibilities have been taken from her son, futures erased. Anger at how helpless she feels. It is from this fury that a determination begins to take root. A determination that the circumstances that have destroyed so much of Renshu's childhood, so much of her life, will not also steal the last of their hope. She resolves to imagine a new future for him. A future of stability, learning, health, prosperity. He will grow strong and attend university. He will become a scholar, follow a life of the mind. He will move forward. He will, even, one day, be able to forget all these sorrows. Chongqing, Sichuan Province, China, February 1942. Although she wasn't expecting him, Maylin isn't surprised when Longwei appears shortly after the new year, bringing rice, oil, salt, and cloth. She accepts his gifts. She'd be foolish not to. These essentials are still hard to get and precious.
Maylin, you've had your time. Come live in Shapingba now.
His haircut is neat and his face newly shaven. He stands tall, almost restored to his old commanding presence, but there is a flicker of uncertainty in his voice. Maylin doesn't say anything.
Look, America has joined the war. This is a turning point. Soon the Chinese will be victorious, I'm sure of it. We can rebuild our nation. We can rebuild our family. Come back, Maylin.
No, Longwei. Wenling's grief is too great. She blames me for Liling's death. Our being there will only torment Wenling more.
Wenling's anger is not my anger. We share our sorrow, not our anger. Come back, he appeals, this time more gently.
Elder brother, I give you my respect and thanks for the many ways you've helped me and Renshu, but we will not move to Shapingba with you. Go home. You have a wife and daughter to comfort. Finally, seeing that he will not convince her, he turns to leave, muttering,
"How did I end up caught between the two most stubborn women in all of China?"
The next time Longwei comes, it is the height of summer. Longwei brings Renshu a small toy car. Amazed at his good fortune, the 8-year-old accepts the gift with glee. Maylin scolds Longwei for spoiling him with such extravagance, but Longwei waves her protest aside. He rumples Renshu's hair, and the boy goes off to play with his new treasure.
"You don't have to keep coming up here, Longwei," Maylin says. "We're fine."
"I know."
"So why do you?"
"I must check in on my only nephew and my brother's widow. For family, family stays together."
"How are Wenling and Lifen?" she asks.
"Lifen is well, in school, studying hard. And Wenling, well, she has plenty of friends with whom she can complain about her husband."
Maylin purses her lips, hiding a smile. Longwei glimpses her amusement and breaks into a loud guffaw. Maylin pulls back, alarmed at the slide into conviviality. She dons a formal face and thanks him, saying,
"Elder brother,
you have been too generous. I imagine you must have important work to do. He won't delay you any longer. And, as if remembering his role, his expression sobers and he nods. Soon after, he leaves. As the years pass, Mei Lin just manages to keep Ren Xu fed, clothed and safe. She finds small jobs at his school or with some of the women's aid organizations, collecting blankets, medical supplies and clothing for soldiers at the front. Sometimes, she helps at one of Madame Chiang Kai-shek's schools for war orphans, sewing clothing and looking after the smallest children. In conversations with the other women, Mei Lin comes to form her own views on the war. She begins to nurture two dreams: a better future for Ren Xu, and continued independence for herself. As much as she hates all that the war has taken from her, this newfound self-sufficiency, however modest, is precious and powerful. A pattern emerges. Long Wei visits twice a year, with gifts of rice, oil and salt. Sometimes he includes cloth or wool. It is usually around the new year, and then later, close to a festival or holiday. He never stays long. Gradually, their conversations evolve away from their shared grief and towards the state of the world, the hope for peace, and the victories and losses of the Chinese forces. Mei Lin is surprised by how much she comes to relish her talks with Long Wei. They remind her a little of her youthful discussions with Xiao Wen. But Long Wei is grittier, more realistic, and these days, so is she. Chongqing, Sichuan Province, China, February 1945. This year, when Long Wei comes, in addition to his usual gifts, he brings new shoes for Ren Xu and a package of tea for Mei Lin. Mei Lin is grateful. All arms and legs and nearly 11 years old, Ren Xu is constantly growing out of his clothes. Over the past few years, not only has he grown in stature, but he's grown in personhood. He's become an imaginative problem solver, much like Dao Hongse. Ren Xu loves to show the other children at school how to make boats from leaves and twigs. He's a hard worker and does his lessons diligently. Mei Lin swells with pride when she sees Long Wei look at him with admiration. "Thank you," Mei Lin says, putting away the gifts and taking down two teacups. She opens the package of tea and shakes a handful of leaves into a tin teapot. She lights the kerosene stove and they wait for the water to boil. Pouring them each a cup, she sighs. "Why is this war still dragging on? It's been 3 years since the Americans joined and still no victory." Long Wei blows on the surface of his tea and shakes his head. "It's been a grim year for the Kuomintang. The Japanese now control provinces on both sides of the Yellow River and continue to advance into the interior. I even heard that the loss in Henan was because the Chinese people revolted. The peasants wanted revenge against the Kuomintang for breaching the river and the famine and floods that followed," Mei Lin remarks. Taken aback, Long Wei scowls. Then he sits up straighter. With both reproach and pride, he responds, "It was, it still is, a time of national sacrifice. We must trade parts of this country for time. To do so, we must destroy any assets that could be used by the enemy." "Like the fire in Changsha?" Mei Lin asks, the words slipping out. She's long wondered. "You knew beforehand, didn't you? The Kuomintang burned the city down on purpose." She watches as Long Wei refuses to meet her eyes. "And what's worse," she says, "the Japanese didn't ever actually attack. Your generalissimo doesn't value human life, just his own legacy. People are tiring of his callousness." "You don't understand what decisions a leader must make," he growls. "I understand that he sacrifices his people without a second thought. I understand that trains and trucks and boats carry government files and equipment when they could carry families to safety." "You should be more careful in what you say." "Why, am I wrong?" she challenges. Long Wei sputters, shaking his head, caught off guard by her forthrightness. Recovering himself, he says,
"We will be victorious, Malin. Soon."
He leaves abruptly. For about a week, his gifts go untouched. But then, Malin, determinedly practical, uses them. By the spring of 1945, the Nazi hold on Europe is weakening. The Allies turn their attention to Japan, firebombing the cities of Tokyo, Nagoya, and Osaka. In China, battles rage even as all the armies, the nationalists, the communists, and the Japanese, are depleted and near collapse. After more than 8 years, the people of China wake one August morning to hear that America has dropped fearsome bombs on two cities in Japan, bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man. The mushroom-shaped clouds they formed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were immense. Loss radiated outwards, blooming for miles and miles and stunning the Japanese into a quick surrender. They have put down their guns and grounded their zeros. The war of resistance, at long last, is over. Chongqing, Sichuan Province, China, August 1946. It is the close of the Hungry Ghost Festival, and Mei Lin kneels at the river, lighting small lanterns in paper boats and setting them adrift on the water. With each one, she thinks of an ancestor or a lost loved one and murmurs a small blessing. She watches as they join scores of other boats bobbing along in the dusk. Further down, out of earshot but still in sight, Ren Xu and a group of boys launch boats of their own into the crowded river. Despite the return of peace, Mei Lin feels further than ever from the life she once hoped to build when she married Xiao Wen. Those dreams belong to someone else. She's not who she was. Not so willing to follow all the old ideas, the new ideas, or any ideas, just because they were her father's, her father-in-law's, or her husband's. Her thoughts have instead been returning, again and again, to her family in the hills above Yitang. She wonders if their remote settlement has carried on quietly through the usual shifts of the seasons, undisturbed by the violence of the cities. Any shame she might have once felt about leaving her late husband's family to return to her own seems irrelevant now. She wants to be among those who have always known and loved her. She wants a chance for her boy and her parents to know and love one another.
"Do you still believe in hungry ghosts?"
The voice is deep, gravelly, and mocking. Though it's been well over a year, she knows that voice. She glances up. Long Wei. When did he arrive and why is he here? He looks down at her with a mixture of amusement and contempt. Yes, especially those who had no proper burial. She gets up and straightens her tunic and trousers. At least I believe in something.
I believe in something.
What? She expects he'll say gold, or power, or the gullibility of others. Or that he believes in strategy, that there's always an angle from which he can see how to win.
China.
She studies him, looking for sarcasm in his expression. Long Wei's face is serious. Not a trace of ridicule lines his eyes or twitches at the edges of his lips. How can he mean this? Though the end of the war initially gave Mei Lin hope, China's peace has been short-lived. After the Japanese surrendered, there was brief cooperation between the Chinese Communist Party and the Kuomintang. Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek even signed a pact of solidarity in Chongqing. But this was just a puppet show, both sides stalling while they regathered troops and strength. Only 10 months later, the truce had collapsed, and fighting between the nationalists and communists had resumed by June. Even old Hong Se had believed in wealth and oil, not patriotism. Could his mercenary son truly have an allegiance to something as insubstantial as a mouthful of slogans? What is China? She finally manages.
China.
He inhales, lifts his chin, arranges his shoulders as if in salute, and looks into the distance, as if he could see the generalissimo himself approaching,
is ours. She does not belong to the Japanese, the imperialists, the foreigners who rolled into Shanghai. She is not the warlords, the emperors, or the Americans. She is for the Chinese people. One people, one country.
Long Wei, Mei Lin interrupts. Why are you here? Why aren't you with your wife and daughter?
China has become a chessboard,
Long Wei continues, ignoring her questions.
Borders are being re-established, territories drawn.
Pah, a country is not a chessboard. His raised eyebrows prompt her to continue. A country is a place to make homes, to grow families and towns and cities, she says. It is not some exercise in military prowess.
No, Mei Lin. China is a chessboard, and the players are the white and the red. We must demonstrate our worth to the players or become pawns.
Mei Lin knows that he's not wholly wrong, but she doesn't think he's completely right either. Why are you here? She asks again. She is in no mood for metaphor.
We have to move. We are going to Shanghai. You will come with us.
Shanghai? Wenling must be thrilled. Why?
I have a new post. Civil servant with the Kuomintang.
So now you have a title.
You must be very important.
This war has been good for you, hasn't it? She taunts, not bothering to hide her contempt.
He ignores her. You will come with us.
It isn't a question. Mei Lin wants none of this. She is not interested in games of chess or chance or whatever Long Wei wants to call it. All she wants is enough peace and stability for her boy to grow, to understand that the world is not always at war, that loss and flight are not life's primary experiences.
Mei Lin, I am here because family stays together. You will join us.
Why do you think we will come with you?
Family stays together,
he says again, as if repetition was the same as explanation. She stares at him, and he starts to cough that smoker's cough. Phlegm gathers in his throat, and he hacks, then spits it out. Long Wei clears his throat again and takes out another cigarette, offering her one. She shakes her head in disgust. The red tip of his cigarette glows in the deepening dusk. More lanterns float by, their orange and yellow flames reflected on the waters. As they stand in silence, her own family comes to mind. She has no desire to rejoin Long Wei and Wenling, but the possibility of going back to her parents, which has seemed like a fantasy, begins to glimmer with potential. What can she trust about this man? She can trust his hunger for power. She can trust his ambition to get to Shanghai and demonstrate his worth, as he says. He wants to be valuable, not as a sacrifice, but as a strategist. His determination is growing. The war has served him well.
I insist. You and Renshu, come with us.
Long Wei repeats. Mei Lin is no stranger to strategy either. Any boat that travels down the Changjiang must stop in Yichang. Knowing Long Wei, knowing Wenling, in Yichang they will probably transfer to a larger, more comfortable steamer that will take them on to Shanghai. This steamer will be big enough that it must sail when scheduled, regardless of whether or not all the passengers are on board. Mei Lin keeps her gaze straight ahead. She doesn't want her eyes or her voice to betray her thoughts. When? She asks.
We'll sail at the end of the month.
Mei Lin looks once more at Long Wei and slowly nods. Okay, she agrees. Long Wei grins. He has finally clenched a long-desired victory. He thinks that she wants and seeks his protection, that she will be grateful for his generosity. As a nod to Mei Lin and her ghosts, he picks up the last of her lanterns, lights it, and sets it afloat. But he's wrong. Mei Lin doesn't want his protection. She wants a spot on the boat. Chapter 8. Changjiang River, eastbound, China, September 1946. 8 years ago, Mei Lin and Renju travelled up the Changjiang in a fog of worry and anguish. Going downriver now, Mei Lin is less desperate, more hopeful. Instead of the adrenaline of immediate need, she begins to feel the qualms of daring to look forward, to dream. In some ways, she's not sure which is more frightening. The river is crowded with boats going east. Everyone is trying to get home. Mei Lin sits alone on deck, thinking about the village in the hills. Once the idea to return to Yichang took hold, she could see Ren Shu with her father, tending the radishes and sweet potatoes. She could feel her hands massaging her mother's back, rubbing away the tension of washing and beating out clothes. If she could imagine these moments so vividly, how could they not be possible?
You're lucky my husband takes pity on you.
Wen Ling's voice cuts into her reverie. Over the years, it has become brittle and harsh. She is still beautiful, but a frailty has taken hold of her. No matter how elegantly dressed or expertly made up, her refinement floats only on the surface, unable to conceal a brokenness beneath. This is the first time Wen Ling has spoken directly to Mei Lin since leaving Chongqing. So far, she has refused, looking past Mei Lin and Ren Shu, or referring to them as if they aren't there. Long Wei hasn't seemed to notice. Either he is blind to her animosity, or he dismisses it as an annoyance. But Mei Lin sees that time has neither dulled Wen Ling's resentment nor softened her grief.
Had it been up to me, we would have left you behind.
Mei Lin presses her lips together. Instead of responding, she studies the mountains. The changing leaves splash the hills with reds, oranges, yellows.
You and your boy stay away from my family. You've only ever brought trouble. Leave my husband alone.
Big sister,
Mei Lin starts, but Wen Ling has turned away. Mei Lin watches the angry woman retreat back into the hold. She considers whether to follow and appease. Perhaps at one time she would have tried, but it would feel like an empty gesture now. A few moments later, Ren Shu joins her. At 12 years old, he is taller than she, his long legs and lean build predicting a swift stride as a man. Xiaowen's cheekbones and strong jaw are starting to echo in Ren Shu's once rounded face.
Ma, I miss Li Ling. I always miss her. But being with Uncle, Auntie and Li Fen makes it hurt all over again.
Mei Lin puts her hand on his and squeezes in agreement. It's okay to still be sad, she murmurs. Our sorrow reminds us of all the joyful moments too. The boat has slowed. Wu Gorge lies ahead. River trackers prepare ropes to guide the boat through the rapids. Although they move with the water's flow this time, it is still a hazardous journey. Passage through the gorge may take hours, or even days if many boats are waiting.
Ma, do you remember telling me in Li Ling that this river was a serpent and the mountains were dragons?
Mei Lin nods.
Remember telling us Li Qi slays the serpent?
Tell me another story.
Aren't you too old for my stories?
No, Ma. Never too old for stories.
For an instant, Mei Lin sees the small boy with chubby legs and a happy laugh. She looks along the river, then up at the cliffs. She notices a small crevice in the hillside. She begins to pull together the pieces of a story she once knew. How did it go again? Out comes the scroll, and she unrolls and re-rolls until she reaches a section where a fisherman steers his small boat through a bed of reeds. Above him rise blue-green mountains whose tops disappear in swirls of clouds.
This is a story, she begins, of Peach Blossom Spring.
Once, not far from here, there was a fisherman called Old Zhu from Wuling who lost his way.
When?
Interrupts Ren Shu.
A long time ago.
When the Qing still ruled?
Ren Shu has become so precise. He wants to know exactly when and where things have happened, are happening, will happen.
Way before that.
Mei Lin waves her hand as if to brush away the centuries. Many, many empires ago.
How many?
Mei Lin considers his questions. She worries the war years have made him wary. He is always collecting information, as if he knows to be on the lookout.
I think it was the time of the Jin.
Yes, the Jin.
Enough questions. Now listen.
Old Zhu, having had no luck with the fish that day, had closed his eyes and fallen asleep. He floated down the river, and when he woke, he discovered a wondrous sight. a grove of peach trees in full bloom. Wanting a closer look, he dragged his boat ashore. Their beauty drew him forward, and he walked deeper and deeper into the forest. The bloom was so abundant that the ground was covered in fallen blossoms. He picked up a handful and inhaled the soft, silky petals tickling his nose. Another passenger standing on the deck is listening. Malin can tell by the way he adjusts his stance to lean closer. Perhaps he, too, is a fisherman. She raises her voice a little and continues. At the end of the grove, there was an opening in the mountainside, like that. Malin gestures at the dark crack she'd spotted earlier. Renju cranes his neck to see, then turns back to her. What next? Did old Ju enter? Of course he did. Wouldn't you? At first, the opening was big enough for him to reach above his head and to stretch out his arms and not touch